From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Will the IRL Champ Car merger pay dividends at the Brickyard this weekend? Ahead on Only a Game, a preview of the 92nd Indy 500. And okay, we'll talk about Danica Patrick if you really, really want us to. Also, how a group of Indianapolis reptiles came out of their shells to celebrate the big race. And Helene Elliott forecasts the annual scrap for Lord Stanley's Gleaming Chalice. Also ahead, I attend a track and field event for the visually impaired and the auditorially sensitive.
Well, I didn't like the gun, but I liked the whistle.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. 11 rookies dot the field at Indy's fabled yard. I hope that none of them find turning corners is too hard, for should they miss a turn or drive too slowly, should they choke, we'd have to call them Sunday drivers. Sorry, that's a joke. In any case, despite the speeds, there is no cause for panic. I wonder if this year the milk jug will end up with Danica. Anyway, the 92nd running of the Indianapolis 500 will transpire tomorrow. Joining me now to talk about the event is Lars Anderson, who writes about motorsports for Sports Illustrated. Lars, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on.
You wrote a cover story for last week's Sports Illustrated on Danica Patrick, in which you said that she is among the best crop of young open-wheel drivers in a generation. Tell me about the other drivers who make that list.
Well, since the merger of Champ Car and IndyCar, which occurred in the off-season, now you have all of the open-wheel drivers in America under one series. And some of the best young drivers are Marco Andretti, who is the grandson of the famous Mario Andretti. You have Graham Rahal, who is the son of Bobby Rahal. Graham is only 19 years old, and he won earlier this year in St. Petersburg and became the youngest driver ever to win. And then you have Danica Patrick, who's just 26, and she won her first race a few weeks ago in Japan, becoming the first woman to ever win. And so really for the first time in over a decade, you have young drivers in open wheel who can become household names, and they have interesting biographies. And so really for the first time, you see IndyCar may be able to mount a challenge to NASCAR to become much more popular.
You mentioned that Danica Patrick won her first race a little while ago in Japan, just last month, and now people like you are saying that she has a chance to win the most famous race in all of motorsports. How is she handling the pressure?
Danica is singularly focused on racing. I mean, she has an amazing amount of determination, which really is one of the key sort of traits of a successful race car driver. You know, Danica dropped out of school at age 16, went by herself over to England to race cars over there, and then she didn't do so well over there, and she came back and basically banged on every door she could find to try to find a ride in IndyCar. And eventually Bobby Rahal gave her a chance, and she was with Rahal for 3 years, and now she's with Andretti Green Racing, which is one of the powerhouse teams. And so she really has a legitimate chance to win this race. She's starting in the second row, fifth place, and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway has traditionally been her best track on the circuit. It just suits her driving style really well. And she is going to try, I believe, to pit sort of out of sequence midway or late in the race to try to kind of steal the race on a fuel mileage game, which is how she won over in Japan.
Danica Patrick is one of three female drivers in this year's race. Is anybody paying attention to Sarah Fisher or Milka Duno?
Not so much. I mean, it's an interesting storyline, but neither Milka nor Sarah are in. They don't have quality equipment, and really, if you don't have quality equipment, you really don't have much of a chance to win. So, other than the interesting sort of side story of having three women in the field, really all the focus is on Danica.
Scott Dixon has the pole position, and he was the series runner-up last year. What are his chances?
He has excellent chance. Traditionally, the driver who sits on the pole hasn't fared very well, but Scott has had the dominant car all year in IndyCar. He's won one race, and he's had the best car in three of the races. This race is interesting because it's so long that, you know, I heard drivers say this all the time yesterday, and I was talking to them. Usually the best car, the fastest car, doesn't win this race. It's a race that you need an extraordinary amount of luck. You need to have your pit strategy right, and you need to play the fuel mileage game. But Scott and his teammate Dan Weldon, who's starting second, both they have pretty much dominated the speed charts all during the month of May here at Indy, and those two really have to be considered the two favorites.
Elio Castroneves won at Indy in 2001 and 2002, and he took the coveted Dancing with the Stars title last fall. The latest Dancing with the Stars champion, Christy Yamaguchi, will be Indy's first female starter on Sunday. So what do you think? Will Elio and Christy get a chance to pair up for a celebrity tango in the winner's circle?
They may do that. Elio's very good at this track. But more significantly, Elio winning Dancing with the Stars really helped sort of elevate the status of IndyCar because he gave a face to the series to people who normally don't tune into the races. As Elio told me a while back, he's everybody's grandma loves him. the grandmothers are very much into that show. And so the fact that he did so well, now you have a whole new audience that's going to tune in on Sunday just to see how Elio does, and it's really been a boon to the entire series.
I want to ask you some more questions, but I'm having trouble getting the image of grandmothers tuning into the Indianapolis 500 out of my head.
Well, you know, hey, they'll take it. They'll take it.
In practice last Saturday, Marco Andretti had the fastest lap at more than 228 miles an hour, but he apparently had forgotten about the Andretti family Indy curse and ended the day with an inside spot on the third row. An Andretti hasn't won at Indy for nearly 40 years. Can Marco reverse that trend?
He can. He's a real popular pick in the press room. Like you said, he's posted the fastest speed of the month, and he probably is the top driver in terms of who can win for the Andretti Green team, which Danica is on, and they also have a teammate, Tony Kanaan. Andretti Green's an interesting team in that the three drivers, Danica, Marco, and Tony, they absolutely share all of their setup information in their cars. They're constantly communicating with one another. And that's something you see on the big teams in NASCAR, but it's sort of rare in IndyCar. So, I mean, that sort of element gives them a real good chance to win on Sunday.
All right. You've mentioned several drivers with real possibilities for winning this race. Time to put you on the spot. Who drinks the milk in the winner's circle?
That's a tough one. I'm going to stick with my original pick and go with Danica. I think the stars are going to be aligned for her, and I think she'll be swigging the milk on Sunday.
Lars Anderson writes about motorsports for Sports Illustrated. Lars, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Danica, Elio, Marco et al. Won't hit the bricks for real until tomorrow, but Indianapolis has already crowned a champion this week. Lynn St. James, an Aldabra tortoise, was declared the winner of the 27th running of the Zoopolis 500 at the Indianapolis Zoo. Lynn was pitted against another Aldabra tortoise, AJ, to mark the move of the tortoises from their winter enclosure to more spacious summer digs. The Zoo's Judy Gagan joins me now on the line from Indianapolis. Judy, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, it's very nice to be with you, Bill.
Mike King of Indianapolis Speedway Radio said this year's finish was the most controversial that he had seen in 10 years. What was the controversy?
Well, the controversy really wasn't that controversial. Here's what happened. AJ is much larger than Lynn, but he was in a mood this year, and he just motored down the raceway with Lynn following. And Tony Kanaan was our guest chief steward, and he had said that the winner was the one who ate the first bite of fruit when they got to the end. So AJ more or less got there first, although it was close. It was neck and neck the entire way. But instead of eating the food, he actually sort of walked through the food.
Oh.
So then Lynn came up a little bit behind him and ate first. So there you are.
So really, if AJ had just been a little hungrier for the win, he might have taken it.
That's exactly right, Bill.
Oh, okay. Andretti Green Racing's Tony Kanaan, you've mentioned, made the controversial ruling. Indy drivers have participated in this event for years. How difficult is it to find a driver who's willing to spend a day at the zoo during what has to be a very busy week for these guys?
Well, it's not a whole day. It's a few hours, and it has not been tough at all. And I must say a special thank you to Sam Hornish Jr., who actually was our guest driver for the past, I think, 6 or 7 years, ever since he started as a rookie at the 500. So Sam was absolutely terrific to work with and is a wonderful guy, and as we know, is off in NASCAR these days. So this was our first year working with Tony Kanaan, and he's just absolutely wonderful, too. So it's a fun event. So I think they actually enjoy kind of doing something a little different, you know?
Well, let's get some of the details out front here. How far do the tortoises travel, and how long does it take a really fast racer to finish the course?
Well, it's not too far. It's in our Dean's Milk Jug Arena in our encounters area, and it's probably maybe 100 feet. I mean, it's not real long, and on a good day, we're talking about 10 minutes.
10 minutes?
10 minutes, yeah.
For 100 feet. I'm not sure I can work that out in miles per hour.
Well, it's not super fast, but for a tortoise, it's pretty darn good.
All right. This year, I understand 4 smaller radiated tortoises also took part in the event, but you wouldn't have known it by watching the event.
No, that's true. We were a little surprised. These little radiated tortoises are tiny in comparison to the Aldabra tortoises, which are large. I mean, AJ's probably somewhere between 500 and 600 pounds, and Lynn about a quarter of that. These little guys are sort of the what you would think of as a normal tortoise. They're maybe, you know, 10, 12 pounds. And they were all lined up behind, and we thought they'd scooter around and give them a race. But no, they were just too small, and AJ and Lynn were just in a mood to race this year. That's always good. The weather was perfect. That helped.
Was there any food left for the little guys by the time the big tortoises got to the finish line?
Of course. They don't eat much. In fact, when they were loading them up to take them over to their exhibit, I kind of peeked my little head in, and one of the little radiated tortoises had found a big hunk of tomato, and he was gnawing away and dripping juice down his little tortoise head. It was very cute.
Well, I think that's fine, and I gather tortoises being tortoises, probably even though there was winning involved, there was no milk involved.
There was milk involved, of course.
Oh, excellent.
With our friends of the American Dairy Association, we had a wreath and the traditional cold glass of milk for the pit crew of the winning tortoise, Lynn St. James.
Everything you say suggests the possibility of another question. What the heck does a pit crew do in a tortoise race?
They keep them moving straight.
Oh.
That's very important. Lynn, for example, kind of blew a tire at one point and kind of scattered off to one side, and we had to get her back going in the right direction. So pit crews are very important in tortoise racing.
Judy Gagan is with the Indianapolis Zoo. Judy, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, you're very welcome, Bill, and happy Memorial Day weekend to you and all your listeners.
My pal the tortoise, how fast does he go? And he goes like crazy. What about you, the cut of his chin? I think the finest cut you'll ever find. What does he file at the hall?
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Okay, so a newspaper photographer assigned to cover a high school track meet in Provo, Utah, wanders into the path of a flying javelin, and it goes right through his calf. The guy takes a picture of his skewered leg because he says if he hadn't, his editor would have said, why not? The coach of the kid who threw the javelin says the first thing that went through his mind when he saw the photographer go down was, good thing we brought another javelin. And finally, on his next throw, the kid who nails the photographer wins the state title. I'm told this state high school championship happened on May 17th. Otherwise, my money would be on April 1st. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, track and field for visually impaired athletes. But first, the Stanley Cup playoffs get underway tonight. The 2008 final features Pittsburgh and Detroit, two powerhouse NHL teams with talent, history, and momentum on their sides. But which will prevail? Joining me now on the line to preview the 2008 fight for the trophy, once owned and donated by the former Governor General of Canada, Lord Stanley of Preston, is Only a Game's hockey correspondent, Lady Elliot of Los Angeles. Hi, Helene.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. During big hockey playoff series, talk inevitably centers on goaltending, so let's start there. Detroit's Chris Osgood has experience in the finals, while the Penguins' Marc-Andre Fleury does not. Will that disparity matter?
I think it will, in the sense that the nerves are going to kick in when you get out there. And it's funny, though, because Chris Osgood, people deride him as the worst goalie ever to have won the Stanley Cup. Well, he must have done something right.
that's still pretty good, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. There aren't that many who've won it. And if you're number 840 out of 840, that's still a pretty exclusive club.
Oh,
I mean,
exactly.
You know, he doesn't have the reputation and the mystique around him that like a Dominic Hasek has. And he's not young and trendy and like Marc-Andre Fleury of the Penguins is. But somehow this guy has managed to get the job done. And at some point, you got to give him some respect.
Detroit and Pittsburgh each boast a considerable amount of offensive talent. Would you say they're approximately equal in that regard?
I'd say probably Pittsburgh may have an edge in terms of scoring talent and depth. You know, you look at things like depth up the middle, and Pittsburgh has some pretty good centers there to throw out there. You know, the Penguins actually do play better defense than most people acknowledge, and that's something that's actually helped them through the playoffs. Everybody looks at them as a scoring team and looks at Sidney Crosby and Malkin, but they do play a two-way game and surprisingly good at it. For Detroit, a lot of it may hinge on whether Johan Franzen is able to play. He missed a bunch of games in the conference finals because of what they call concussion-like symptoms, which is hockey terminology for, yeah, he really got a bad headache.
Yeah, really, he didn't know where he was after he got knocked down. Yeah.
I love how in the playoffs everything becomes so mysterious and you have an upper body injury or a lower body injury. And what we usually figure is, you know, teams will only give out information saying upper body injury or lower body injury. And I work on the diagonal principle that if they say upper body, I figure it's lower leg. And if they say lower body, I figure it's left shoulder.
Much has been made in recent years about the circumstance in which the NHL placed itself after the most recent lockout. What needs to happen in this year's championship series for the league to feel that it's really gotten back into the public consciousness?
I love how you say most recent lockout. It's scary. You have to think of the NHL on that term, but it's twice tried to commit suicide, and the game is so good that it survives despite the people who run it. The NHL's recovery has been very, very strong. You look at the numbers and their revenues. I mean, their revenues are over $2.5 billion. They've been actually forward-thinking in terms of things like video and working with YouTube and a lot of streaming video on their website. And digitally, they've been ahead of all the other leagues. There's no question. But there's still this barrier, it seems to me, that, you know, as exciting as Sidney Crosby is, as terrific to watch as Evgeny Malkin is, and as wonderful as this series figures to be, I just don't see the league making that leap to the level of viewership and revenues that the other three sports have. There's just something that holds them back. And whether that's the way that hockey doesn't televise well or people's perceptions that hockey is still played by a bunch of toothless Canadian backwoodsmen, I'm not sure, but there's just something missing there that hockey just can't take that final step.
Helene, the Detroit Red Wings have enjoyed a strong following for a very long time. They won the Cup three times over the last 11 seasons. Is it a good thing for the league to have one of those original six teams win it all in this era of expansion?
Absolutely. I think the Red Wings deserve an enormous amount of credit for maintaining such an incredibly high competitive level for so long. And this is under different economic systems, you know, the pre-salary cap era. Now we're in the salary cap era. They've done incredible scouting over in Europe. They have some incredible Swedish players, and they've been able to
fill in with free agents. I mean, I think adding Brian Rafalski after last season and, you know, bringing him in this season was a terrific move for them. They've found ways to win. And, you know, that's why people say that, you know, in the salary cap era, you're never going to have one dominant team. Well, explain to me then how the New England Patriots keep succeeding and how the Detroit Red Wings do. Oh, well, thank you, Bill Belichick. No, It goes, okay, all right, we'll leave that one alone.
The Penguins won the Stanley Cup in 1991, again in 1992, but they've struggled to remain solvent since then. As recently as a year ago, they were candidates for relocation. Pittsburgh's story has got to be encouraging for fans who've given up on their respective NHL teams in the past, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the Penguins went through some horrible times with a bankruptcy, which was actually their, you can say it was their most recent bankruptcy, which is really scary, too. Mario Lemieux stepped in and saved the franchise, essentially, and he's done it a few times. They finally got the financing arranged for a new arena, and that's supposed to open in 2010, I believe. And it really is encouraging for teams that are lower in the standings, can you say Los Angeles Kings, that, you know, you can rebuild quickly. The Penguins were terrible as recently as the 03-04 season. And obviously getting Mr. Crosby certainly helped accelerate their rebuild. But it can be done if you do it right. You know, it's not a matter of throwing money at people. It's a matter of drafting right and finding the right chemistry. But it can be done.
All right, Helene, I'm sure you've been hoping that I would forget to ask the last question, but it is your time to shine. Which team takes home the chalice?
Hey, last time I picked against the Red Wings, I got some fairly nasty emails, and I'm not sure they're going to let me back in the city of Detroit, actually. But my head says Detroit, my heart says Pittsburgh.
It's sort of an upper body, lower body thing. Well, upper body, upper body thing.
You are quick.
Helene Elliott covers the NHL for the Los Angeles Times. She's also only a game center ice soothsayer. Thanks again, Helene.
Thank you.
It's a mild, sunny weekday afternoon on the campus of Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, Massachusetts. Such a beautiful day that as I look out over the green dandelion-dotted infield and the composition track that circles it, it's hard to imagine that on Saturday this place is going to go nuts. That's when the Eastern Athletic Association for the Blind, an organization of schools from Massachusetts to Florida, will stage its 62nd track and field tournament, an event originally designed to demonstrate that students who are blind can be athletes too. Athletes, and as became obvious on Saturday morning when the events got underway, fans as well.
On your marks!
One of the competitors in the 50-yard dash was a slight 20-year-old woman named Erin, who was representing the West Virginia School for the Blind in Romney, West Virginia. Erin and the two other competitors in her heat would race while holding on to devices that slid along cables running the length of the sprint course. Erin's coach is Donna C.
Erin, you got to go when he blows the whistle. Listen. Go, Erin, go!
For blind sprinters, finishing the race is only part of the challenge. After they cross the finish line, they have to turn around and follow the cable back to the start. Maybe it's excess adrenaline, but most of them run back to the starting line.
You're almost here. You're almost here. Stop.
Nice job, Erin.
There. Good job. You won that heat?
Yes, I did.
Yes, you did. Watch. Here's your cane. You cold? You want to put your jacket back on?
Yes, I'm cold.
Though Erin is a veteran of track meets like the one at Perkins last weekend, I learned after her race that there are some aspects of the competition to which she can't seem to get accustomed.
Well, I didn't like the gun, but I liked the whistle.
And they accommodated you. They blew the whistle instead of shooting the gun.
Yeah.
Most of Erin's responses to my questions about her triumph on the track were short and to the point, but when I asked her about the dance, scheduled to follow the awards ceremony on Saturday evening, she suddenly became more loquacious.
I wanted to dance with Carl, but Carl's the bus driver, but so I might dance with him this evening. I like Carl.
He'll be a lucky guy if you do.
Yeah, I want to dance with him tonight.
The attraction of the dance notwithstanding, it's the competition that has provided the incentive for Erin and her teammates to spend 12 hours on the school bus in which the aforementioned Carl carried them to Watertown. Donna C. told me that each of the athletes from West Virginia had earned his or her place through competition back home.
We do have 2 months of practice prior to this, and we let them try all the events, and we try to pick out the ones that we feel they're the best at and have the best chance of winning a medal. Because they do give medals for the first six. Oh, gosh, forgot to warn you again. They do get medals for the first six places. So we try to put them in an event that we think that they would possibly get a medal in.
The competitors are divided into categories, depending in part on the degree to which they can see. Runners with partial vision often compete on their own. Distance runners who cannot see are tethered to a sighted runner who had better be able to keep up. Triumphant in the former category was a lanky 18-year-old named B.J. Peterson, who won his heat in the 440 going away. B.J. was representing the Maryland School for the Blind, and while the three young men running against him were reduced to jogging and gasping for breath with 100 yards to go, Peterson cruised by them and then to the wire. There, he revealed his strategy.
I was thinking of basically doing the same thing with the mile, keep up with them, and on once I got right over to the where we started at, just to start running as fast as I could.
Yeah, it worked out that time, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Excellent.
For a minute, I thought I wasn't going to be able to beat that one kid from New York for a second.
BJ has been to three of these tournaments. According to Hannah Marley, who coaches the girls' team at the Overbrook School for the Blind in Philadelphia, athletes with that sort of experience, no matter whose colors they're wearing, are counted on to help their teammates.
We have a few girls who are here for the first time. They're really nervous, but they have the older girls who've been here for 4 or 5 years, and they really just look up to them. And I'm only my second year, so sometimes I look up to them for their help as well, because they sometimes know what's going on better than I do. But the younger girls just follow in the footsteps of the older girls, more or less, yeah.
Let's go, Rashida.
Don't jump.
Do your thing, girl. Come on, don't look to the side.
Watch your hands, please.
Are you ready?
The encouragement was palpable throughout the meet on Saturday, not only at the track but at the pit, where students were competing in a variation of the triple jump, and in the infield, where they were throwing softballs and footballs and putting the shot. Nor were the competitors the only ones who were excited and happy on this day, though Earl Haley, the coach for the New York Institute track and field team in the Bronx, said he feels this way pretty much all the time. Coach Haley, born in Guyana, has been helping children with various disabilities learn to run and jump and throw for 17 years.
I love to see the kids run. I love to see them compete. And, it gives me great joy just to see them having fun and they compete against each other. And I enjoy watching them doing it. And I enjoy working with them. I look forward, I look forward to go to work. I mean, I know a lot of people don't say this, but I look forward to go to work.
If I were to go back to the Perkins campus today, I'd find that the bang of the starting gun, replaced sometimes at a runner's request by the whistle, and the encouraging shouts of coaches and the roar of the excitable crowd had given way to the customary quiet of the green campus. But I'd also find that the competition and its aftermath have not been forgotten by those students fortunate enough to have participated in last Saturday's celebration, a group for whom 19-year-old John Mazzetti, a Perkins student, spoke eloquently about the significance of the track meet.
I think it's really cool. I think because you get a feel of how different schools are run and the different people at different schools. And, as Perkins, we're already very diverse, but to see, multiple cultures intertwine or multiple groups intertwine to make one big group, it's pretty awesome.
The 63rd annual potentially awesome Eastern Athletic Association for the Blind track and field tournament, featuring competitors determined not to let visual impairment prevent them from running, jumping, throwing, and renewing friendships, will occur next May at an EAB member institution to be named later. You're listening to Only a Game. Our coverage of two of horse racing's premier events, the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, and the death of eight bells at the Derby, resulted in dueling reactions. Suzanne Artemief emailed to say she was stunned and extremely disappointed that we hadn't talked to a veterinarian who is not connected financially to the track. Gail Patterson of Spindale, North Carolina, was also disappointed that we hadn't explored the issue of animal cruelty. She wrote, "I went to the Kentucky Derby in 1966. What I saw was a lot of drunk, over-the-hill people in silly hats and silly clothes. Very disgusting people. Very disgusting sport." Dr. Philippe Masser felt otherwise. "I listened to your interview of the two horse racing authorities with fascination," he wrote. "You elicited insightful explanations, and I feel now that I have a better understanding of a world with which I previously only had passing knowledge." Herb Bates of Amherst, New Hampshire, appreciated the story last week about Team Slipstream Chipotle. "At last, a story on cycling and drugs free from hysteria and innuendo," he wrote. "Kudos to Nancy Greenlease and Only a Game for some reasonable coverage of the effort to clean up some of the mess." Naomi Walcott, who is currently living in Japan, was among the listeners who appreciated Ken Shulman's story on sumo wrestling. "Having just watched my first live match, I found Mr. Shulman's story provided helpful background and also captured the drama that surrounds this sport in Japan." Beverly Amsler's story about the martial arts instructor who uses a wheelchair provoked C. Thomas Dillon to bring to our attention his martial arts instructor, J.A. Cooper of Virginia, who, Mr. Dillon informs us, is legally blind. He suggests we should give Mr. Cooper equal time. And finally, there was alarming news from Trumansburg, New York. Steve Sirik, the self-confessed Grand Commissioner of the International Rutabaga Curling Federation, whom we spoke with several years ago, emailed to say the runner bearing the eternal rutabaga flame has gone missing, perhaps as a result of, quote, constant harassment and having vegetables thrown at him. The Grand Commissioner says the flame bearer is a 6'3" Swede with a purple and yellow toga bearing a sometimes flaming rutabaga atop a wooden pole, and he urges anyone with information regarding the runner's whereabouts to come forward. Whether or not you have your tongue or your rutabaga in your cheek, you can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can contact us through the website, onlyagame.org, or leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Soccer fans converging on the Vienna area for Euro 2008 will no doubt be pleased with the free guide that's been developed to help them procure the essentials there. Without this aid, visitors might be baffled by the thick local dialect, but once they've mastered the guide, they'll be able to say, "Do you have a sliced sugared pancake with plum compote? And another gherkin for me, please." Visitors will also learn what to say when they kiss the hand of an Austrian woman. For those inclined to less formal approaches, the guidebook includes this phrase, "Servus Feschikatz." Though the literal translation is "Greetings, hot kitten," the guidebook claims the phrase means "Hello, princess." What could possibly go wrong? I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Should your child join a travel team before he or she learns to walk? But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
How can you travel if you can't walk?
That's
it's a basketball conundrum.
And people are going to have to keep listening to hear the answer to that one. The Lakers took a 2-0 lead over the San Antonio Spurs last night in the Western Conference Finals. Boston and Detroit are even at one game apiece in the East. Is it too early to predict a Lakers-Celtics final?
It's much too early to predict that, in fact. It's not too early to predict the Lakers part of it, I think, because right now they look like they're about three steps too young for the Spurs to stay up with.
The Chicago Bulls won the NBA's draft lottery on Tuesday night. How much good will that stroke of luck do them?
Well, they have a big decision to make between the two freshmen, Michael Beasley from Kansas State and Derrick Rose from Memphis. I think they'll go with Derrick Rose for two reasons. Number one, he's local. And number two, Chris Paul has made Derrick Rose a very wealthy guy because all the birds on the wire are all flying off at once in the NBA now say you need a point guard more than you need a big guy who could score.
Tim Donaghy, the former NBA official who acknowledged last August that he took money from gamblers and bet on games where he was officiating, charged this week that other officials, as well as coaches and players, have been involved in gambling on NBA games. Do you agree with the league's assessment that this is, quote, a desperate act of a convicted felon who is hoping to avoid prison time?
Well, it may well be a desperate act of a convicted felon who's trying to avoid prison times, but that doesn't mean it isn't true. And I think that for the league to dismiss it quite as blithely as it had so far, much less the fact that the media seems to have done the same thing, is unconscionable to me. You're right in the middle of the brightest spotlight the NBA has year after year, and one of its former referees says that players and referees and coaches are involved in gambling on NBA games. Pete Rose must just sit at home at moments like this and bang his head against the wall.
Manchester United are European Champions League champions. Chelsea are not. Man U's Ryan Giggs said it was fate. Do you like that explanation?
All right. Now, those of you at home, the next noise you hear will be Bill falling off his chair. I watched the entire second half of this game and the extra time and the penalty kicks, and it was enormously compelling. But I got to tell you what, Ronaldo is the happiest guy in the world right now. Because when John Terry slipped and missed the penalty kick that would have won it for Chelsea, he took Ronaldo off a hook the size of the Empire State Building. Because Ronaldo, as far as I know, consensus best player in the world, put Man U, by missing his own penalty shot, in the position of losing that thing. And you talk about getting fricasseed in the British tabs. Oh, my Lord. It was a very compelling sporting event, and I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Can somebody put a call into hell to see if it's frozen over, please? We'll just check that, and we'll get right back to you. Charlie, if you were the trainer of the horse that had won the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, would you announce that at the Belmont Stakes you would be in the winner's circle while the horses were still at the quarter pole?
Maybe not, but this horse, yes. This is a joke at this point. Big Brown is bigger and browner than everybody else and will win easily, I think.
The Stanley Cup Finals begin this evening. Red Wings and Penguins. Who do you like?
I'm going to pick Le Penguin, as we say in the NHL. I think the legend of Sidney Crosby grows by the day, and he will be enough.
I didn't know they talked like that in Pittsburgh.
We.
On Thursday, the International Ice Hockey Federation Hall of Fame inducted its first females. Cammy Granato, Geraldine Heaney, and Angela James joined Mario Lemieux and Igor Larionov. Sparkling company, that.
Terrific company, and good for Cammy Granato, who was out there alone for an awfully long time as the standard bearer for women's hockey.
Humpy Wheeler, for 30 years,
yeah,
one
baby.
Of NASCAR's top promoters, did his best to seal IndyCar's thunder this week. Did he succeed?
He sort of did. He retired. He got pushed out, actually, by Bruton Smith, who owns the track. Somebody once said, most of the people go to the Charlotte racetrack to watch the cars race. Some of them just go to see what he'll blow up before the race.
He is the master of promotions.
I mean, at one point, he actually staged a reenactment of the invasion of Grenada, which couldn't have differed that much from the actual invasion of Grenada.
About the same size. This reminds me, Charlie, who wins the Indy 500 tomorrow?
I have no idea. Let me look at my list and see who's right.
Danica.
No, it's not going to be Danica. And I do not think it's going to be Sarah Fisher, who's also running. I will do this because, as you know, when in doubt, pick the names you like to say on the radio. Helio Castroneves.
Helio.
Helio. C.
This week, NFL owners.
As they say
owners.
In Pittsburgh.
And in Detroit as well, I'm quite sure. This week, NFL owners voted to opt out of the current collective bargaining agreement, which won't change anything over the next two seasons, but did make possible that there might be no salary cap in 2010 and that there might be a lockout in 2011. Does it come to that?
I don't think it comes to the lockout, but I think it's very possible they'll play a year without a salary cap so everybody can go, see, we needed the salary cap. The worst thing about this, of course, is that it will mean, if the worst happens, it will mean the end of the NFL draft, and all across America, People in team jerseys will be seen staggering, blinking out of their mother's basements.
Say, former Only a Game producer Gabe O'Connor will be absolutely crestfallen.
And his crest is pretty up, pretty
absolutely,
far up there.
Absolutely, absolutely. Do you suppose NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell is hoping all the football news that broke this week will distract fans from the NFL-related stories involving convicted steroids dealer David Jacobs and the former Patriots lineman who backs up Matt Walsh's assertion that Bill Belichick illegally used players on injured reserve during his practices?
So in other words, you're saying you think Goodell is arranging for news to get out that the NFL might immolate itself 2 years down the line in order to distract
it beats the present. It beats immolating itself this week.
Yeah,
right?
the interesting one for me was Ross Tucker, the offensive lineman, who said that he essentially confirmed what Matt Walsh had said about Patriots practicing players who were on injured reserve. The NFL sooner or later is going to get fed up with the fact that Bill Belichick seems to think that every single comma of the rule book everybody plays by is open to, as he would put it, an interpretation.
And finally, Charlie, what sort of insurance do you suppose the Indianapolis Motor Speedway had to buy before Edith Pittenger of Muncie, Indiana, got to ride around the track a few times?
A 96-year-old great-great-grandmother. Good for her. And you know that for the first time in history, having an old person leave the blinker on didn't matter because all the turns are in the same direction. So no one really cared. Good for you, Edith.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you see her on the street, don't try to choose her.
If you feel our culture has encouraged us to take the games children play too seriously, you have a friend in Tom Farry. In his new book, Game On, Farry discusses the remarkable lengths to which some parents are going to make their toddlers potential champions. He also explores the extent to which we have failed the enormous majority of youngsters who show no particular aptitude for a career in pro sports by depriving them of the opportunity to simply play. Tom Farry joins me now from the studios of WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut. Welcome to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
You begin your book by writing about a laboratory where a woman considering artificial insemination can order up the sperm most likely to provide her with an athletic offspring. Was that for shock value?
No, not at all. I felt that was a window into the world of youth sports in 2008. It's a development that has occurred just in the past few years where this sperm bank in L.A., you know, collects the sperm of elite college athletes as well as many other college students. But they sell it, and it sells very fast. In fact, it gets sold out. And now in this country, we prize athletic traits. Many of us do. Mm. So it doesn't surprise me that a number of people are choosing the sperm of college athletes and then, you know, sometimes getting very excited about the potential of those kids that they have to become athletes themselves.
You maintain that the symptoms of a culture focused too early on the athletic potential and achievements of its children are many. Travel teams for 6- and 7-year-olds, youth league coaches insisting that 8- or 9-year-olds specialize in one sport, children leaving home to live closer to coaches, the list goes on and on. So why pick on Earl and Tiger Woods?
Well, I don't know if I pick on him exactly. I mean, you look at Tiger, and he's so impressive. He's a fantastic golfer. He seems to be an excellent citizen, represents himself very well. There's really a lot to admire about Tiger and a lot to admire about how Earl raised Tiger. Earl had this notion of creating a golfer from an early age. Yes, he wanted to create a good citizen and all that too. But, you know, he's putting a club in Tiger's hands very early on. You know, playing certain music in his room to create a certain, rhythm in his brain. Had him on a very aggressive track very early on and pressed all of the right buttons in terms of getting a kid to like the sport and then finding success. The only question is, at what point does your dream become your child's dream? And if you've got a 2 or 3 or 5-year-old, have they really gotten old enough to figure out what they want to do with their lives. I mean, my parents, I'm very grateful to them. They pretty much said, look, you have a childhood, and it's up to you to figure out what you want to do with it. We're not going to ask you to go into the family business. We're, you know, you figure it out. So my mother was a flight attendant. My father was a realtor, and I ended up being a journalist. You know what? And that's great because I know it's my life. Now, Tiger's not going to complain about how he was raised. I wouldn't expect him to. He's making about a jillion times more money than I am, and he's a success in every way. But I don't think I would raise my child that way. I don't think I would be so aggressive in creating a golf journey, as Earl Woods called it.
Earl had Tiger sitting in a little chair in the garage well before Tiger could walk while Earl was hitting golf balls into a net. I mean, he was watching golf before he could make any decisions about it.
Yeah, it's an iconic story. I mean, the interesting thing about the Earl and Tiger Woods story is it wiped away the cautionary tale that we heard for many years about manufacturing athletes, how you can't do it and the hazards of doing it. Earl and Tiger come along, and it was such a compelling example of success that parents really responded to that. So now we have the Callaway World Golf Championships for six-year-olds. We have AAU National Championships for second graders in basketball. We have, you know, the AAU handing out gold medals for tumblers in national competitions at age four. It's just pushed down, down, down. We have this notion that we can manufacture an elite athlete. And you know what? It happened with Tiger, but it doesn't happen in the vast majority of cases.
You conclude at one point that there is no evidence that sport immersion works with most kids in most sports. Does that mean that parents should resist coaches who want those children to, for example, play ice hockey not only in the winter but also in the fall and then go to hockey camp in the summer?
Yes, I think so, at least through until kids get into puberty. I mean, there's this tendency in this country, and you allude to it. It's called early specialization in sports. But the vast majority of athletes that you see on the pro level played multiple sports into their teenage years. I think of Roger Federer, who is my favorite athlete, and his whole game is based upon beautiful footwork. Well, that footwork doesn't come from an extreme focus on tennis from the age of three. That footwork comes from him playing soccer into his teenage years. He played a lot of soccer in addition to tennis and I'm sure other sports as well. You know, it's not that competition is bad or organization is bad or, you know, a lot of the things we see out there. It's just what is age appropriate and when do you apply some of these impulses?
As you point out, if we go by per capita Olympic medals, Australia is far more successful at developing champions than the U.S. is. What is Australia doing right?
Well, the Australians, like Americans, love sports. But they had a crisis just as we did in the 1970s when the East Germans and the Soviets were winning a disproportionate number of the medals. They said, the government's going to invest in this. We're going to create something called the Australian Institute of Sport. And this place now gets $40 million in federal government funding each year. And it's just a campus of sports scientists who just do incredible research and then pass that research down the pipeline to coaches and throughout the sport culture there. So people in that country know you really should not specialize in sports at too early of an age. You know, they're not going to put these kids in the sports schools until they get to be teenagers. And then once they are there, they're not going to overburden them with, you know, tons and tons of games. There's going to be more practices and more working with therapists and everybody else that they have there. And so they're very, very efficient at creating, you know, Olympic medalists. You know, on a per capita basis, they're number two in the world, right behind the Bahamas, which just means the Bahamas just has like one or two good sprinters. And then the U.S. is down at actually number 39. So We are not efficient at all in creating champions.
Tom, you contend that one way for parents to ensure that their own children don't get caught up in sports programs that can be destructive would be for them to organize their own sports programs, quote, around the needs of kids, not adults. But how do parents organize something that goes against the tide of the travel teams and the elite teams and the rest of it?
Yeah, you know, Bill, I've heard that from so many people. I said, well, what do we do about it? Well, I mean, honestly, it's as simple as democracy in action. Just get involved. The vast majority of these teams are organized by some board. It might be your local youth soccer board or you know, little league baseball board. So I encourage parents who want to dial down the environment or make it more age appropriate for children to run for the board or support people that you like on the board, you know, or just run for your town recreation committee and say, look, you know what? Anybody who wants to use these fields, the coaches have to be trained. And we're not going to let these fields be used by, say, travel teams until sixth grade. So I say, you know, just get involved and lay down some standards.
Are you optimistic that that can happen, or is the train running too fast in the other direction?
I'm very optimistic that can happen. A funny thing happens in sports. You know, once you have kids, your favorite athlete is no longer LeBron James or Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods. It becomes the athlete you're raising. It's the one upstairs, you know, in the bedroom who you have the emotional and the financial investment in. So I think there are a lot of parents out there who would like to see an environment that is productive for their kids and wouldn't mind getting involved in some capacity.
Tom Farry is the author of Game On, The All-American Race to Make Champions of Our Children, published by ESPN Books. He spoke to me from WNPR in Hartford. Tom, thanks very much for joining me.
Great to be here, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Jim Doyle and from Gene Amatruda at WNPR in Hartford. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view my track and field photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from starter Skip Wellman, who gives instructions to competitors in the 440 at the EAAB track and field tournament regarding changing lanes.
You can cut in anytime, but don't knock the guy over, Sadie.
Don't knock anybody over? How are we training these athletes these days? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.